Party, too, told the visiting Bay Area activists that from the start of Newton's visit, the Texas people found his behavior disturbing. It seemed to his host that Newton was on drugs. And they're going to accuse him of everything, rape, drugs, killing little children, brutalizing children. On Newton's last night in Texas, he met with the group in its nightclub, decked out in a cape. He strutted around the room screaming, "I am the Supreme." He made a play for the women leader of People's Party 2, the chief woman leader, asking her to dance. She told him she was there with someone else. An argument ensued. In the course of the altercation, Newton hit the woman, delivering severe beating to her escort, and threatened to kill another person who tried to intervene. The incident ended as quickly as it had begun. Now, it's amazing that the white press has never told us about this, the capitalistic newspapers before. Newton left the bar and headed back to Oakland in the morning. But the woman told the Bay Area activist, this unknown activist, that the man Newton had beaten flipped out shortly afterward and was still institutionalized in an insane asylum. Oh, this is outrageous. Oh, damn, this is outrageous. The woman herself admitted to being so devastated that she had not done anything political since the incident. Oh, that gives reason for her being not involved in liberation any longer, just because of the devastation. Well, that's too bad, dear lady, that your commitment was so little, even if it had been the case, that you would allow one man to devastate you and give up your civil rights views and your socialistic views. Moreover, she said, the local party was demoralized and weakened by the startling affair. This behavior was in sharp contrast to Newton as a genial host to scores of luminaries. Now, they want to get these rich luminaries away from him, who answered his summons to share fine cognac and a long, rambling conversation. Visitors would arrive at Newton's expensive penthouse apartment in Oakland. They never talk about an expensive penthouse of the rich, but no, my, they're going to really make hay with him in that penthouse. That's why I always thought he shouldn't have been there, although he claimed he had to be on the top floor to be safe, and there's no doubt some truth in that. Newton's penthouse apartment, they would arrive, expensive penthouse in Oakland, and find themselves ushered into a modern, expensively furnished living room of brown leather couches and stark walls. They would breathe in the heavy scent of gardenias floating in a brandy snifter, and Newton would flatter his guests with attentiveness. "When I was up there," says Alameda County Supervisor John George, a black lawyer boosted into office with Panther support, "he would serve me, he'd bring me a drink or a sandwich, and he would fix it himself. He didn't ask Gwen, his secretary, to do it. He would sit sipping Remy Martin, and we would talk. He always seemed so happy to have someone to talk with." Well, that seems to be the only name they can come up with thus far. Because of Newton's charm, guests such as John George willfully ignored the dark rumors they heard about him. "I like him," George says, shaking his head in a troubled manner. "That is why I may continue to excuse and excuse." Naturally, he's going to have to be a little apologetic with all the white press and police and all the capitalists after him. But here, George, you see, even though he's a supervisor, can't accuse him of anything really bad. Among some of Newton's former intimates, too, there is a tendency to excuse his violence, or even to deny it. Take the case of Bobby Seale, who founded the party with Newton and Hilliard. In 1974, Seale, who was then the party's chairman, reportedly was beaten and had to be treated by a doctor for his injuries. Now, no name for the doctor, no one named that saw the beating. By several accounts, Newton ordered his bodyguards to train their guns on Seale to ensure he did not fight back while Newton administered the terrible beating. After the attack, Seale left the party and disappeared from public view, emerging only within the last year to publish a book on some kind of new stupid form of religion. Reached by phone in Philadelphia, where Seale now lives, Seale denies he was ever beaten. "It's not true," he says. "The police put out a lot of crap initially. I've even heard that off and on, but I don't pay any attention to it. Whoever said that is lying." Now, why would this Bobby Seale, who's also got involved in religion, not say he was beaten? He's far away in Philadelphia, and there's no Panthers left. Every Panther headquarters has been destroyed all over the nation. The only thing left is a little handful in Oakland. If he was beaten, he should talk about it. No, he doesn't. But this magazine is outrageous. Even with Seale denying it, "whoever said that is lying," him saying, The magazine goes on and says, but it was said by many who were not police, who were in a position to know, including someone who treated his injuries. Jesus Christ. Everybody, these unnamed people know more about it than Bobby Seale, who says it's a big lie. It never happened. What injuries? Seale screams into the phone. I had no injuries whatsoever. I don't give a damn who said it. Tell them I said they're a flat, black-ass, motherfucking liar. Or a white-ass liar. Whoever the hell they are. I guess maybe Bobby Seale's now being picked up. Because Bobby Seale's in religion and very straight. I guess they want to haunt him. It's not good enough that he's changed. That's why you people ought to take a look at the thinks when you ever decide you want to be a think to save your ass. They never let you get, they never get you by this very screaming and making him look like insane and calling, you know, white-ass liars and so forth is a scenario set up to go after Bobby Seale later, probably. Seale's departure came in July 1974. Justice Newton, according to the Alameda, that's in Oakland, County District Attorney's Office, police and various witnesses, was embarking on a bizarre rampage of intermittent violence that would stretch over 18 days. It began on July 30 with a run-in he had with two plainclothes cops in the Fox Lounge in Oakland. Newton accused them of following him simply to harass him. He turned belligerent, the police said, and pointing a finger gun like at one of the officers, screamed for bodyguard Robert Hurd to shoot him. Shoot the pig-ass motherfucker. Shoot him. When Hurd slipped his hand into the briefcase he carried, the policemen drew their weapons. Inside the briefcase was a loaded .38 caliber revolver and $1,000 in cash. Now you know damn well they're not going to pull a gun on a bunch of police. Hurd was busted. Later that night, with other officers for reinforcement, Newton was also arrested, along with Panther Heavies, Larry Henson, and Flores, that's F-L-O-R-E-S, Fly Forbes. It was just the kind, he went by Fly, his nickname. It was just the kind of event to jack Newton up. It heightened his schizoid paranoia, made him crazy, as one of his friends says. Here, again, who's a friend? 6 days later, Kathleen Smith, a 17-year-old prostitute, who they'd never been able to find under that name as existing, that's my commentary, and her friend Crystal Gray were standing on an Oakland street corner hustling Johns, prostituting, in other words. There were other prostitutes in the vicinity as well. It was a slow evening, a Monday before midnight. Crystal and Kathleen, or Kathy as she was called by the other woman, smoked a joint together. They were both feeling mellow. As Crystal later testified at a preliminary hearing, when a big fancy metallic colored car cruised by their corner, Crystal hailed the occupants with a "Hey, baby." The car kept going and stopped at the light. Both women noted with some appreciation that the car was a Mark IV Lincoln Continental. 10 or 15 minutes later, Crystal noticed the same car again, parked at the corner on a side street. She saw one of the occupants, the light-skinned one. "Get out." He got out of the car. "Which one of you ladies called me?" Crystal later quoted him as saying. The two women exchanged glances. Those, what's his trip expressions, and stepped back, sensing trouble. The man stared hard at them. Suddenly, Crystal said, he lunged forward and struck Kathy. Her eyes got big, Crystal later recalled, and Kathy stumbled backwards. Crystal was angry and said to the man, "Say, brother, why did you hit my girlfriend? She didn't do nothing to you." Everything to make people feel that he's oppressing people, picking on prostitutes now. The man's chilling, cold response, she said, was to draw a small silvery gun from his breast pocket. Crystal yelled to Kathy to run, and she herself made for the nearby Ebony Plaza Hotel. Hearing her cries, the other prostitutes ran inside the hotel, all except for Kathy. Crystal went back outside to see what had happened to her friend. As she did, a shot rang out. Rushing to the sidewalk, Crystal saw the same man standing over Kathy's slumping body. The Mark IV slid out of its berth and swung over towards the tableau of a wounded Kathy held in Crystal's arms. The light-skinned man jumped in the car, and it sped off. Now, why in the hell is a guy who's always supposed to be picking up prostitutes going to step out and shoot her and look with all the world to see over her slumping, dying body? It's ridiculous. It's just totally ridiculous. Kathy had been shot in the jaw and was unconscious in a coma. The trauma from the wound damaged her spinal column and put her in an immediate coma. It was a half-death that lingered for 96 days, when hospital authorities finally decided to move Kathy's inert, paralyzed body to a nursing home to continue life-sustaining treatment. The shock of the move was too great for the small spark of life still left in her. She died. I'm sure that if she did exist, they would want her to die, because if she lived many more days, they couldn't have charged her with murder. Because if you don't die within a certain amount of time after you've been killed, which laws are now being changed all over the United States because of black crime, the Boston Globe, that was something that came over the news last night, that if someone dies 5 years later, the person can be, if they somehow injured them, they can be charged with murder. It's an open, blatant fascist law. If someone hit somebody in the head and 5 years later they died, or they even had an innocent brawl, they can be charged with first-degree murder. But not then. The law wouldn't enable them to get Huey unless she died. So it's very convenient that she dies en route to a new nursing home. The small spark of her life that was still left in her couldn't take the move, and she died. Three prostitutes identified Huey Newton as the man who pulled the gun on Kathy. One of them was Crystal Gray, and her testimony, authorities believe, would be the most convincing to a jury. Yeah, that's what they want. Frame him. 11 days after the shooting of Kathleen Smith, two young women stopped in at the lamppost, an Oakland bar nominally owned by Newton's cousin, Jimmy Ward, but run by the Panthers. They ordered hamburgers, and then, according to the police statement of one of the women, Helen Robinson, Robert Hurd came to the table and began to get smart with her friend, Diane Washington. Washington sassed back, and it turned mean. Hurd whispered something to a little guy, and the next thing they knew, the little one came over and grabbed the other woman, Helen Robinson, by the jacket. He yanked her off her chair, and then he and Hurd began pushing her back and forth. They each socked her whenever she came within their grasp. The little guy was Huey Newton. Now, again, they're beating on poor innocent women, the two women said. According to Robinson's statement, the two men then knocked her to the floor. Eventually, someone in the bar, Robinson, it's not sure who, grabbed her by the collar and threw her into the street. Now, it's amazing this prostitute will give her name when business people will not give theirs. Obviously, business people would have more protection than a street prostitute. She's probably getting a lot of money, and she's surely not very afraid, because she's giving her name here to back these lies. But eventually someone in the bar, Robinson's not sure who, grabbed her by the collar and threw her into the street. Trouble is, you see, the Panthers did own businesses like this lounge, and they were getting too big, giving too much encouragement to movements of liberation, so they had to be destroyed. Several times she tried to return to get Washington out, but each time she was rebuffed, thrown out. It was 7 or 8 minutes before Washington managed to escape from the bar. Robinson noted that Washington's lips was big and bleeding. Her jaw was swollen, and her eye was kind of black. Jesus, you'd think that a little of this would be enough to destroy this man. They just keep it going on and on. Robinson said that Washington had actually made her way out of the bar at one point, but that Huey Newton came out after her and dragged her right back in. The women called police that night, and 6 days later made a complete report and identified Newton and heard from a series of 12 photos marked with numbers, no names. The lamppost bar incident had occurred in the early morning, about 4 a.m. Later that day in the afternoon, there was more bloodshed, this time in Newton's own apartment. Yes, he's a murderer. He even sheds blood in his own apartment. The victim was Preston Collins, C-A-L-L-I-N-S, a handsome, middle-aged, middle-class black tailor. His account of the incident 2 days after it happened, oh yes, always after it happens, was tape recorded by police. I know he's not afraid to talk. Callan said that 3 weeks earlier he had been introduced to Newton at the lamppost by a mutual friend. The two had met before but didn't really know each other. Collins did know, however, that Newton ordered his clothes from men's store in San Francisco, and that the store in turn farmed its orders out to Collins. Collins told this to Newton in the lamppost and suggested they eliminate the middleman. That Collins, C-A-L-L-I-N-S, make Newton's clothes for him directly. Newton agreed, gave Collins his phone number, and suggested he give him a call. Again, little old Taylor, not afraid to give his name because he's paid well enough. Why are all these other sources so afraid? After trying for several days, Collins finally reached Newton and was invited to come over and measure him for a suit. The tailor arrived with his materials packed in a sample case. Newton greeted him and began showing him around the penthouse apartment. He did everything but get down to business. Collins later told police he was drinking some cognac. I think he paid $19 a bottle for his cognac. God, they all try to make him look like he's wasting the people's money. And he was drinking the whole time and drunk as a skunk. Very potent stuff. I asked him to pour me just a little taste. I wanted to see how it tastes, you know. Yeah, this poor tailor never tasted expensive liquor. To know, and I wanted to show hospitality. Newton told Collins he would order a bottle of the same cognac for him to take home. And he did so by speaking into an intercom to a woman in another room. But doesn't sound like he's too unfriendly then. Why would he be unfriendly with this man? He was going to offer to tailor his clothes and cut out the big businessman, the middleman. That would be to Newton's advantage to be kind to this man. But let's go on. Seated comfortably now in the presence of another man whom Collins said was Newton's brother-in-law, or possibly his uncle, the two began to talk. He says, I'll tell you what, everybody's been ripping me off. Preston on getting clothes made, Collins recalled. Now if you give me a full price on a suit, one price, he said, I'll have all my clothes made from you. I said, I can make you a suit for $180 with my material. But Collins said he never got around to showing Newton the materials in his sample case. I had a suit that I had on that he kept telling me he didn't like. And I said, well, I didn't bring this suit over here for you to like. I'll show you some samples. But he wouldn't let me show him any. So he said something like, he said, oh, goddammit, I've been ripped off, blah, 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 blah. Now, what's that supposed to mean? I said, oh, baby, don't feel that way. When I said baby, that's what started the whole thing because I have a habit of calling my friends baby. You know my wife, my mother's, my other friends, I call baby, and he didn't like that. Now trying to imply that he's homosexual and insecure and can't stand to be called baby because he has a feminine sort of face, you know. He jumps up and he goes buggy. Nobody calls me no damn baby. Then Collins said Newton marched from his dining area where they had been sitting and returned with a .357 Magnum revolver. I'm sitting talking to his brother-in-law across the table, Collins said, and he, Newton, whacked me several times. I mean hard blows right across the back of my head while I was sitting at the table. Blood shot everywhere. Then he turned around and whacked me on the other side again and again. Then he said, I'm going to shoot you. And I said, oh, man, you going to invite me to your home to start some stuff for nothing? What's wrong with you? I'm sure that's the way a man going to talk. If he's been beaten all that many times, he wouldn't be able to talk. So he says, oh, man, you call me a baby, and I don't like you no way. You're a little bit yellower than I am. Now, ain't that pitiful? Trying to make him look like he notices people's color of their skin. This is outrageous. Jesus Christ, overkill. I don't like you. I said, oh, man, get off of this shit. So then he hit me again, and he hit me and knocked me on the floor. He kicked me in the mouth, and by that time I was tired of being hit. Amazing. This guy's still tired of being hit. He's not unconscious. I jumped up and hit him in the mouth, knocked him upside the wall. By that time I was bleeding. I was bleeding a lot. I had lost, I bet you, 3 or 4 pints of blood. Ain't this ridiculous? 3 or 4 pints of blood. Outrageous. He wouldn't even be able to get off his feet with the loss of 3 or 4 pints of blood. Outrageous damn stuff. I mean, and they may think the American people, now this is what it says, I was bleeding. I'd lost 3 or 4 pints of blood. I couldn't be no match for that little youngster there. Collins managed to make it to the apartment door. It makes him look like he picks on middle-aged or older people, too. Collins managed to make it to the apartment door with 4 pints of blood gone. Jesus Christ. Unlock it and stumble out into the hallway. But Newton followed him. Now he had a different gun. The first was of no use to him anymore. I wonder why. Why would it? A gun's a gun. The first was of no use to him anymore. The grips, Collins told police, had broken on his head. Oh, I see. Collins tried to hide in a small recess of the hallway. He says, I'm going to kill you, motherfucker. He came and he followed me, and he made me go back, and by that time I was just bleeding everywhere. By the time I got to the door, I just fell on the floor, blood all down the hall and all in his apartment. I saw his brother-in-law. I told him, I says, you You must be out of your mind. Can't you stop this maniac from doing what he's doing? The other man tried to calm Newton down. In the meantime, Collins said Newton had called in two of his bodyguards. Newton beat him again and again, according to Collins' statements, and then brought out a tape recorder and tried to pressure Collins into making statements that would exonerate him and prove him innocent. He asked questions like, did you come in my house and molest me? It's the same lines they said we do. Same old scenario. I said no, and each time he hit me, each time he slapped me, boom, boom. He said, did you do me wrong in my house? I said, no, I didn't do no wrong. I came here in peace. I came to make you your clothes. You offered me a drink. Now imagine a man about to die. He'd say anything if you had really done this. He'd have said, yeah, I didn't do wrong. He'd have been glad to get out of there. I took a little shot, and you got drunk. And then you started hitting me upside the head with your pistol, and I couldn't stand it. That's why I hit you back. Collins said the two bodyguards then brought a car around from the garage. Collins was ordered out of the building. Now, why wouldn't they just murder him? Because he says he resisted them, wouldn't say he was innocent, that he was guilty on the tape recorder. He was supposed to have killed everybody else. Why'd he let him go home? He asked for his sample case, and the big fella, whom he later identified as Robert Hurd, retrieved it, got it back for him. Oddly, Collins said Newton ordered Hurd to get the gift bottle of cognac for Collins to take home. Now that, Jesus Christ. The two bodyguards then ushered Collins downstairs, placed newspapers on the floor of the car so Collins wouldn't bleed on the carpet, and drove him home. They ordered him out and chucked his sample case onto the sidewalk beside him, threw it out on the street. As Collins fumbled with his garage door lock, he fainted. His wife called the police and an ambulance. Collins was taken to Kaiser Hospital in Redwood City, where his four depressed skull fractures required neurosurgery. When police visited him in intensive care to take his statement, now he's in intensive care. This is too much. Collins told them, every time he hit me with that pistol, you could hear the bones crash. And yet he managed to walk home and unlock his garage door before he faints. In a preliminary hearing last fall, 3 years later, Alameda County Deputy District Attorney Tom Orloff, noted racist, I'm saying that, called Collins to the stand to give testimony against Newton on the pistol whipping charges. The tailor shocked the courtroom when he said that while he remembered the beating, he could no longer recall the perpetrator who did it. Oh, now that's convenient. He said his memory loss was a result of the injuries he suffered. Despite the playing in court of his tape-recorded statement to police shortly after the beating, in which he clearly described Newton as a sole assailant, Collins could not be shaken from his testimony. Well, maybe the police is the one that did him, beat him up to try to get him to talk. What Collins failed to tell the court, New Times has learned, was that he had recently received $6,000 from the Newton side. Oh, he's a rich tailor. Why would he need $6,000? That's not very much money at all. Collins refused to comment on his testimony. When asked about the money, his lawyer, Howard Moore, he defended Angela Davis. Howard Moore denies Collins was paid off for his silence. Anybody has the right to sue anybody in civil court. He fumes, implying that the $6,000 represented settlement of claims Collins had against Newton, and no doubt it did. Alameda County records, though, show that Collins never filed suit. Well, that's often the case. You don't have to file it. They threaten to do it, and they pay off. Sheldon Otis, O-T-I-S, Newton's lawyer, says that Collins passed along verbal demands for civil damages for injuries to his person. Beyond that, Otis refuses to comment on the matter. He was not involved in arranging for the payment. Howard Moore puts it this way. Mr. Collins had a claim against Mr. Newton for personal injuries, and that claim has been resolved. Howard Moore, by the way, is an attorney who wants to visit here. We want to remember that, maybe invite him along with some others. By the end of August 1974, police had filed a variety of felony counts against Newton. Of course, we'll check him out, too, to see if he's not an agent. There was the assault charge stemming from the Fox Lounge altercation, or fight, with the plainclothes cops, which was later amended to include charges relating to the shooting of Kathleen Smith. Yeah, amended. Whenever they want more, they didn't feel they had enough, so they add something else to it. The beating of Preston Collins also was added to it, and the incident with the two young women, that was also added to it at the lamppost that was owned by the Panthers. When Kathleen Smith died nearly 3 months later, the charges were amended again to include a murder count, of course. But Newton was long gone by then. Sources say he had fled to Mexico and from there by boat to Cuba. The Cubans granted him sanctuary on the condition that he keep his nose clean, live modestly, and work. Newton agreed. When I was there, he wasn't doing much work. He was just sitting in an apartment, a defeated man, because he needed to be back in the United States. And we all know that conflict, but there was more. I think Huey did like the taste of the bourgeois too much, or he would have appreciated Cuba. Jesus, how I'd love to have lived in peace in that beautiful apartment they'd provided him. When Newton failed to show up for a preliminary hearing in late August, the reason I say I know he didn't go back to action or to fight, because I painted the picture just as clear as it was, that there was no hope. And he could see that, but he said if he didn't believe there was hope, he couldn't live. That's why I distrust all socialists who commit themselves without the acceptance of the possibility of defeat. It's a full, rich life you live when you're socialist. Whether you're defeated or killed, there's no difference. The purpose is to live by conscience. That's the only thing that gives peace or dignity to your life or any meaning. And everybody dies. Except even the people here who I've resurrected look forward to that on occasion. Everyone dies except somebody close to me. And then we have such a rich life if it were just one day standing up for what we believe, giving people hope, helping so many babies as we have here. Saved a baby in a mother's life a couple of days ago. Every week we save some baby. We got a new baby, you know, beautiful new baby. Panther August, let's see. When Newton failed to show up for a preliminary hearing in late August, Panther lawyer Charles Gary met with reporters. Charles Gary is our lawyer. Met with reporters to announce that Newton had jumped mail and fled because pimps in Oakland had put out a contract on his life. Well, that's very likely, too. To prove it, Gary played a tape-recorded phone conversation he had with then-police chief Charles Gain. Gain had called Gary to say that an underworld source had tipped off police to the contract, but Gain's phone call had actually taken place almost a year before Newton left the country. So they're trying to make out Charles Gary a liar now. Charles Gary no longer works for Huey. Some force inside of the Panthers got him to give up Charles, and Charles said it was Elaine Brown. Gary says it was Elaine Brown, and she's been proved to be an agent provocateur. But even though she came out and offered evidence against the Panthers, she too now has been charged with murder of some woman floating in the East Bay in Oakland. As Newton fled to Cuba, it seemed to many in Oakland that the party was breathing its last gasp. But that judgment was premature. That's why this magazine's so sad he's back again. And they're so vindictive. They never, never, never forget, no matter what you do. They are a vengeful people, capitalists, white capitalists, and all capitalists. There were to be 3 years of impressive and previously unimaginable Panther inroads into the Oakland political establishment. This would all occur under Elaine Brown, Newton's successor. The glamorous 34-year-old Brown had come to Oakland 4 years earlier from Los Angeles, where she had interrupted a singing career. I hope you will listen to this and study it. Some said you wanted to hear it. I can't risk the only copy. This is like hell for me to read all this. And I'm the one that knows some of the history that can give you interpretation, which is important because some of you even believe everything you read. Where she had interrupted a singing career, she came from where she had interrupted a singing career in Los Angeles to work for the party, the Panthers. She was smart, articulate, that means well able to speak, and completely loyal to Newton. Qualities that helped her rise quickly through the ranks. With Newton's blessings, as he left the country, Brown became chairperson of the party. Even from Havana, the beautiful capital of Cuba, he remained number one, conferring regularly with Brown by telephone, monitored by the CIA, and more private messages delivered by trusted couriers. Even this magazine admits it was monitored by the CIA. Well, interesting. But it was Elaine Brown who engineered the party's sudden acquisition of respectability. Brown buzzed about Oakland in a red Mercedes, big car too, rich car, and always dressed with the, what is it, the elegance of a young woman executive. She had a flair for public relations, using the Panther School, begun under Newton, to gain favorable publicity for the party and to impress state and county officials. Even the governor, Brown, was about to give her a post like he offered me. Then when it came out that she was an agent, and the party was under attack, he acted like he never knew her. That's always the case. And from Alameda County, the cities of Oakland and Berkeley, the state of California, as well as private donors, she landed a series of service and educational grants for the party that came to over $300,000. Part of the grant money funneled into the party came from the Law Enforcement Assistant Administration, LEA. Now, even trying to make it look, I guess, like it's a communist source, and it's one of the most right-wing agencies in the world. The only way they could have got any money from that was because Mrs. Brown had... They wouldn't give that money to Huey. It was because Elaine Brown was an agent and was earmarked, this LEAA assistance, for a Panther program to help juvenile delinquents. Bay Area leftists noted with amusement that the LEA, formed in the days of law and order to aid local criminal justice systems, was a favorite agency of the Nixon administration. Now, I noticed me, myself a pure socialist, nobody ever offered us any money. When you're really a pure socialist, they never offer you any money. We never were offered a dime, not a dime. We never got a penny from anybody. I had to earn it by the sweat and blood of my brow and other things of my body. Jesus Christ. Only that proves Elaine Brown was indeed the agent that has come out by press to say she was. During Elaine Brown's tenure, Oakland's first black mayor, Lionel Wilson, Judge Wilson, and Alameda County's first black supervisor, John George, were both helped into office by the crucial campaign support of the Black Panthers. 1 year before his election, John George had been Brown's campaign chairman when she herself ran for a seat on the city council in 1975. She waged an impressive campaign and finished only second. She got all the Democratic group's endorsements, George says. They recognized that the Panthers were moving into the legitimate political arena, and it was better to go to work with them than against them. In previous Panther attempts at public office, most Democratic politicians had been skittish about forming alliances with a party that had Newton at the helm. In Newton's absence, the way was open for cooperation and trade-offs. Yes, because Elaine Brown was a sellout. But they remember, they don't pay their finks well. She now, too, is charged with murder. Elaine Brown's rapport with politicians didn't stop at the Alameda County line. In 1976, she went to the Democratic National Convention as Jerry Brown's delegate, and the governor couldn't have failed to notice that when nearly all of his other California delegates had switched their votes to Jimmy Carter in a show of unity, once his nomination was assured, Elaine Brown remained steadfast in voting for him. Perhaps that is why the governor agreed to see her when she came to Sacramento to lobby for completion of the Grove Shafter Freeway in Oakland, a project stalled by his freeze on highway construction funds. Speaking on behalf of an ad hoc organization formed largely by Republican businessmen in Oakland, Elaine Brown argued that without the Grove Shafter Freeway, a huge downtown development plan for Oakland would not be built. Thousands of jobs were at stake, she said, and she had won a guarantee from the development's backers that a percentage of the jobs would go to hard-pressed minorities. She said she didn't give a damn about the freeways. All she wanted was the jobs, says J. Anthony Klein, legal affairs secretary to the governor, who attended the meeting. She was very convincing. We did what she wanted done. We agreed to complete the freeway. This is an effort to get Brown now, I suppose, making him a part of something illegal. Even Brown, a sellout, is going to pay because he worked with some liberals that he thought was to his advantage because he never had any principles. But they're getting the stage set for him to be defeated by the Attorney General right-wing fascist who's tried to frame me openly and reveal it to the public. I don't even know his ugly name. The Attorney General of the state of California. It's Evel Younger. But despite the high regard in which she was held by officials in Oakland and Sacramento, Elaine Brown, there were others who quietly referred to Elaine Brown as the Dragon Lady. Sources say she had a pronounced vengeful streak. Sources say again. A local television reporter, for example, says Brown, who was then press spokeswoman for the party, called him after he had broken the story of Bobby Seale's disappearance and resignation. The reporter says Brown told him, "We know who you are, and if you ever come to Oakland, you're in trouble." After that, he says he stopped pursuing the Seale story and has not wanted to cover the Panthers since. My. I never knew any news people that were discouraged. With all of our power, we had plenty of it. They don't get discouraged. They are a vicious bunch. It's a lie. Elaine Brown's precise relationship to the squad is not clear. It is known, though, that the group continued its criminal activities during her administration. Now, why would they do this to her? Good think that she was. And there are no reports that she moved against it. Some squad members served as her bodyguards, but unlike Newton, Brown did not tour the streets and bars with the squad on shakedown runs. And it could be even that this is a schizophrenia of Paul Avery, who don't like finks. Nobody likes a fink, even though he's willingly doing the establishment's biddings in destroying the threatening symbol that Huey Newton represents. So he's going to take slaps at Elaine Brown, too. During Newton's three-year absence, there were a series of robberies, shootings, and murders that police regard as the work of the squad. The murderous squad, again. Other sources close to the Panthers, see all this other sources. How easy it is to destroy anyone. Don't have to name a person. Just say other sources close to the Panthers share that belief. Witnesses in most of these cases refuse to make formal identifications. Of course, that's convenient. In others, identifications were impossible because the assailants, the murderers, wore ski masks. Jesus Christ. Going through the town with ski masks. All the cases are unsolved, save one murder for which a Panther, George Robinson, was convicted. The conviction was later reversed because of an illegal police search. But Oakland and Berkeley police, who are careful not to simply list any unsolved crime as Panther-related, see squad involvement in the following cases. Oh, now it's convenient. They're going to all their unsolved murder cases. Tommy Johnson. There's a big black sign pointing to these people, so all the public will believe that Huey Newton is a senseless killer. Tommy Johnson was a doorman at the Brass Rail, a Berkeley after-hours bar operating as a private social club and regarded in the surrounding community as a headquarters at the time for cocaine dealers. At 6 a.m. on August 27, 1974, the 19-year-old Jackson was admitting a customer when a car pulled to the curb and several black men inside opened fire with shotguns. All the students should take note of this, the teachers too, of how they destroy anybody they want to in the press, the arm of capitalism, the fist that reaches out to destroy first, then the authorities come later and finish it off, are assassins. Jackson was killed and several customers in the bar were wounded. Club owners Wilbert Latour had reportedly balked at squad demands for money, although he denied it to the police. Case still unsolved. The Brass Rail was the scene of two other murders. Willie Ralph Duke, 24, was a heroin dealer who police informants say was making payoffs to the Black Panther squad. They say anything. Anything they can say what they want. He had reportedly missed a payment because he had lost his money. While Duke was drinking at the Brass Rail on January 25, 1975, with three Panthers and club owner Latour, Billy Carr approached Duke and suggested they step outside. Police have theorized now, that the 21-year-old Carr was attempting to warn Duke that he was going to be killed. As both men began to walk away from the bar, say witnesses, here again witnesses not named, the three Panthers suddenly pulled guns. Two of them opened fire and shot Duke. Carr tried to stop them and was also shot. Both men died. Neither Latour, who saw the shooting, nor the other witnesses would name the three gunmen. Case unsolved. Oh, God. Latour himself was found murdered. 4 months later, Oakland police, acting on a tip that he was dead, went to Latour's apartment and found his car gone. A week later, another tip was received that Latour's car could be found in the San Francisco International Airport garage with his dead body inside. It was long dead. The body had been stuffed headfirst into a sleeping bag and jammed into the trunk of the car. Case unsolved. Another big black mark by this. On April 26, 1975, Vernon McGinnis, a dope dealer known on the streets as Preacher Man, was gunned down by two shotgun blasts and 5.45 caliber shots. Several days before his murder, McGinnis had been approached in the lamppost to buy a copy of the Panther newspaper. He refused, reportedly, saying the Panthers ripped people off. The remark led to an argument with Panthers, Robert Hurd, and George Robinson, both squad members. McGinnis was bounced from the bar and killed several days later. George Robinson was convicted of the murder, but the conviction was reversed because police had improperly conducted their search of his car when he was arrested, making the police look like their hands are tied when they're living in a police state, USA. The district attorney's office is appealing the reversal. Although the motive established at the trial was a lamppost altercation or fight, several sources familiar, here again, several sources, unnamed, are familiar with the case, believe the killing had much more to do with drug-related payoffs to Panthers. Now they got The Panthers involved in pushing dope. Anything to tear their image up. Two other shootings involving shotguns were thought to be the work of the Panthers. Thought to be. What a hell of a way to... The magazine becomes juror and judge. It becomes the court. I thought ins were not to be judged, were not to be executed in the press. I thought that was one of the guarantees of the Constitution, but it doesn't work anymore. So two other shootings involving shotguns were thought to be the work of Panthers because the spent shells found at the scenes had markings almost identical, almost now, to those in the McInnes case. Police could not act on the evidence, though, because there were no eyewitnesses, oh shit, as there were in the McInnes case, and because shotgun casing marks are not as specific as those from handguns. That's true, but if they wanted to do it, they could have framed him. One case involved Philip Cole, an owner of the Black Knight Bar. Cole was reported to have been the victim of Panther extortion, although he angrily denies it. On September 12, 1974, he was shot at on the street. The bullets missed. Cole could not identify his murdering assailants or attempted murderers. In the other case, a week before the Vernon McInnes murder, two men were shot. This is a long damn thing. Oh, Lord. Two men were shot soon after leaving the lamppost. Willie White lost both an arm and a leg in the shotgun blast, and James Harris died from the wounds he received in the back of his head. Both men had been in an argument with a lamppost cocktail waitress that had widened to include others. Case unsolved. Just because now he had a fight with a lamppost waitress, that's supposed to mean that he was murdered. They were murdered by the Black Panthers. What a reasoning. In February 1975, one dope dealer was robbed at his home by two armed blacks in ski masks, and another dealer was kidnapped by three black men and killed. Police suspect the Panthers because of the reports that both men were being shaken down by the squad. Finally, there's still the unexplained murder of Betty Van Patter, the party's attractive 45-year-old white bookkeeper. She was a Berkeley liberal who dabbled in the more faddish aspects of the occult, but was nevertheless described by a former associate as a first-rate bookkeeper, very responsible. Van Patter landed her job in the summer of 1974. She was hired originally to keep books for the Panther School, but her duties expanded soon after to include bookkeeping for the party itself and for the lamppost bar. Although pleased to be working for the Panthers, Van Patter told some friends that the lamppost was not paying its taxes and that money was taken directly out of the cash register and passed along to the party squad members. Van Patter, capital V-A-N, capital P-A-T-T-E-R, was known to be fastidious about her work, and she didn't like going along with accounting procedures she considered illegal or shaky. Betty Van Patter disappeared on Friday, December 13, 1974, even appealing to people's superstition, Friday the 13th, after having stopped in at one of her favorite Berkeley bars. She had entered alone, saying said acquaintances, and was out of bed, although usually she is slow and considered in her movements. In other words, she's normally slow, but this time she was very fast. She retrieved her .38 revolver, and without wasting a gesture, dialed Richmond police. While holding the phone, she heard the sudden round of ripping metal and realized the screen door had been torn completely off its hinges. Someone was out to kill her. It had, of course, to be that, she thought, because there was so little in the house that anyone would want to steal. At first, she recited her address to the police. As she recited her address to the police, the first shot was fired outside. The lock, she thought. He's shooting off the lock. Oh, she knows it's a he. She dropped the telephone receiver on the floor. Well, of course, she'd heard a voice, so that would fit in. She dropped the telephone receiver on the floor, pointed the gun at the back door, and fired. The very act of firing the gun she had kept for so long but never used panicked her further. That and a fusillade of return fire, the muzzle flashes coming through the doorway and lighting up her kitchen. She ran to a small room in the rear of her house to hide, locking the door behind her. Cowering in there behind the furniture, this poor little lady, it seemed forever before she heard the crackling of police radios that indicated she might finally be safe. Outside Mary Matthews' door was a pool of blood and a 12-gauge shotgun. On the sidewalk lay the dead body of a black man. From the trail of smeared blood, police could tell the man had been dragged and then dropped, and the blood went beyond the dead body, indicating another assailant had been wounded. In searching the area along the Richmond Ghetto Street, a block of corrugated metal warehouses interspersed with a few houses and vacant lots, police found a second shotgun, an automatic rifle, and ammunition. They also found discarded clothing similar to that worn by the dead man. From these items, police surmised there were at least three assailants and that the discarded blue overalls and watch caps were probably donned to be shed after the killing in order to make eyewitness identification difficult. It was a cold, planned murder attempt. Now, how did Mary Matthews, firing one shot, kill one man and wound another? Rather strange. But why Mary Matthews? It didn't make sense. They don't even bother to get into that. Now, this is so damn wild that it's outrageous that this senior lady is able, never shot a gun before, never used it before. She's able to hit right directly with one shot. Yes, I want to check back here. Yes, one shot. And she kills one man and wounds another. Why Mary Matthews? It didn't make sense. What would anyone have against this middle-aged mother and grandmother who worked as a bookkeeper out of her own modest home? The answer came from the pink clapboard house directly behind Mary Matthews. She owns that house as well, renting it. It's two apartments to a single...